Quite frankly, what you've pointed to is the big problem in the craft distilling industry right at the moment, which is a glut.
This project really is sort of a love letter to Australian wine.
We want to bring people back into rum and not scare them off.
A maritime Tassie single malt whisky felt like the right thing for the three of us to do.
In a perfect world, all the best grapes from the best vineyards would go into the hands of the best winemakers. Doesn't always happen that way.
This is the Drinks Adventures podcast. I'm James Atkinson, and this is the show where I speak to some of the world's most exciting producers of beer, wine, and spirits and uncover trends and issues in the drinks industry today.
Whiskey production disappeared from New Zealand in 1997 with the closure of the Willowbank Distillery in Dunedin. But in 2009, Tasmanian entrepreneur Greg Ramsay brought together a group of investors to purchase Willowbank's remaining stocks and relaunch New Zealand whiskey to the world. Greg joins us this episode as we explore some of New Zealand's little-known whiskey-making heritage and the whiskey renaissance that's now underway. His company, dubbed the New Zealand Whiskey Collection, is currently preparing to launch some modern expressions, having begun production in 2021 at its own distillery installed at Spates Brewery in Dunedin. Well, Greg Ramsay, thanks so much for joining us on the Drinks Adventures podcast.
Thanks for having me, James. Looking forward to it. I've been listening for a long time.
I think it'd be really interesting just to kind of go back to the earlier stages of your career and maybe just kind of tell us how you got interested in whiskey in the first place and then some of your earlier involvement with the industry in Tasmania.
So I grew up on a farm in the central highlands of Tasmania, and we had Australia's oldest golf course on the farm. So I sort of grew up with golf all around it and this very rich Scottish heritage, very early settlement, 1822. Out of that, I was very interested in trying to learn how to turn this golf history into golf tourism. So when I was 18, I thought I'd have a gap year before coming back to uni, and I spent a year in Scotland, in St Andrews, working in the Old Course Hotel, which at that time, the upstairs level of it is still called the Roadhole Bar, looking up this famous golf hole, but it had the world's largest single malt menu. So we had 266 single malts, which wasn't that common back then. I mean, now obviously there's whiskey bars everywhere, but to be honest, even in Scotland, they were all drinking blends. I mean, it was really very discerning drinkers that, you know, knew the difference between a Lafroig or a Lagavulin or a, you know, Mortlach from a Glenlivet. And it was often the Americans who knew a lot more about the single malts than the locals, all the sort of folklore of Isla and the Speyside. And so that was an amazing year because United Distillers, which is now Diageo, launched the classic malts of Scotland. So it was the first real investment in the terroir or the regionality of different whiskey styles. So we were a feature embassy bar for them to really promote these different styles. So they invested a lot in us as I became a whiskey masterclass barman was my title. It all sounds a bit of a wank, but that was the people who were qualified to take our visitors in the hotel on a whiskey tour of Scotland, which meant we gave them a lowland, which for them was Glenkinchie, then a Highland, which was Craganmore or Dalwhinnie, then a West Highland, which was Oban, and then an Island, which was Talisker, and then an Isla, which was Lagavulin. So we learned a lot about them, and the distillery, as in the United Distillers, actually had brand ambassadors and distillers coming to our property for our training, and every other week or 3 weeks, we would actually be invited and hosted by these distilleries. So it was an amazing year to learn about all the different styles and stories of whiskey.
And so then you returned to Tasmania, and I'm gathering that you had some idea in your head that you wanted to have involvement in the industry, which must have been just kind of in its embryonic stages at the time.
Yeah, what it actually did was I came back and had a bit of a clearer vision of what I wanted to do with the golf tourism, but learning what I did about whiskey, there was this beautiful old flour mill on the farm that we already owned quite a lot of called Nant. And I thought, you know, with Australia's oldest golf course, wouldn't it be amazing to turn that derelict, beautiful old building into a whiskey distillery? So I came back with a clearer vision for that and ended up selling that business plan and project managed that whole conversion. And obviously the Nant saga, you know, is a very...
So you sold the business plan to...
To Keith Batt.
Keith Batt?
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you get paid?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. Oh, look, to be honest, in the early days, I would say Bill Lark, Peter Bignell, myself, all the people that really, you know, were key sort of contractors and consultants to that project. It was nothing but a joy. It really was to breathe life back into that building, particularly say for Peter Bignell from Belgrove Distillery, because it was his great-grandfather's, you know, mill. You know, they actually owned that farm for many generations. But obviously the way Nance ended up now, it's sort of, for Bothwell, for our community, it's such a shame. It's bordering on being an embarrassment for our community. You know, really, it's just the way it's all worked out from such great aspirations.
Yeah. Mm. You worked very closely with Bill and Lynn throughout that period?
Yes. So Bill and Lynn were looking at buying it as well, and I had some investors come down. I even had John Laws come down for a whole day and, you know, pick his way around Nant. And I just dreamed up and developed Barmboogle Dunes, a big golf resort on the north coast of Tasmania, you know, which was a great success right from day one. So I had a bit of wind in my sails of converting these ideas sort of into reality. But unfortunately, I couldn't raise the money before Keith came and visited, and he loved the property. And at Barmboogle, I'd leased the coastal dunes for the golf resort. So I approached Keith when he settled on buying the property about leasing the mill, and he wanted, you know, he's interested, what would I be using it for? And I explained it to him, and he said, well, actually, I've just started drinking whiskey, and as part of the business plan transaction, he paid me to take him and his brother all around Scotland, and we did about 25 distilleries in about 12 days, just to give them a sense of the different scales, small and big, and where the industry was at. So it didn't worry me that I didn't own it, because Keith was at that time, you know, really, really good to deal with.
And so then, yeah, I suppose what's the fill in the gaps between then and then the decision to invest in the New Zealand whiskey collection?
So after Nant opened, and, you know, it was a beautiful restoration of this, you know, very significant structure, Australia's oldest working flour mill into a whiskey distillery and destination, I put my shingle up as a golf, tourism and whiskey consultant. And I reckon it wouldn't have even been 2 months later, I got a call from some accountants in Queenstown who had taken into receivership this huge stock of single malt and blended whiskey distilled in Dunedin between 1987 and 1993. So it was 80,000 litres of whiskey in 440 barrels. And we got sent this inventory, and the accountant was hoping I could go over and help value it, as in give him a value, a number, for him to then go out to market. And I didn't feel I could pick my way through 440 barrels, so I paid Bill Lark to come over with me and as part of our fee. And Bill and I went through the whiskies, and we got sent this inventory list, James, which had all the single malts detailed, you know, how many litres, the ABV, you know, the year that they were all distilled. And then it just said at the bottom, 236 barrels, blend. That's all it said. And we thought, how amazing, this really aged old single malt. But what we immediately saw when we were there to taste the whiskies and assess them was, wow, this blended whiskey is really something, because the previous owners were a big winery family from Hawke's Bay, Mills Reef Winery they owned, called the Preston family, and they had taken almost all the old Wilson's blended whiskey that was in really ratty old casks, and even some of it was vatted, and they put it into their ex-red wine barrels.
Wilson's?
Wilson's was the blended whiskey of New Zealand, literally from the late 60s right through until...
Right.
And Seagram's bought this distillery in 1983, the big Canadian company. They were the ones that started really investing also in single malt. That Dunedin Doublewood that I've got here, that was really the most provenance of New Zealand whiskey, because it was French oak and New Zealand red wine barrels. Whereas the single malt, which is all delicious, I've got some 30-year-old here for you to taste later, which is obviously our oldest whiskey. It didn't have a real particular point of difference. It's delicious. It's just like any classic Speyside whiskey. But it was really the blend that we grew the brand and grew a real following and built our sales channels around.
Maybe if we could sort of go back into the history of the New Zealand whiskey collection. Obviously, there was a decision made at some point to cease operations. How did that come about?
It is an interesting story, and it's got some parallels actually to Hillier's Road in Tasmania, where dairy company, a co-op of dairy farmers that had formed a milk processing company, decided, what can we diversify into with our skill set? So that's how, you know, dairy farmers got into whiskey. So what happened in the 1960s, a really big coffee blending family who had also got into malting to make basically Milo, and it was actually the New Zealand brand's Maltexo. they were looking at, well, what can we do here to use our skill sets but diversify? Because they had a sort of, I think, a lot of very mature cash cow businesses, but what could they do with some growth? So in 1965, they appointed a young scientist straight out of food tech at uni to come up with a distillery. No one in Scotland would share any information with him. He went to Scotland. No one would let him in the door and talk to him. But luckily, he bought, somewhere in Auckland actually, a 1887 technical manual of a distiller's review, literally this old book from the Victorian era, and he built a distillery there in Dunedin as a pilot distillery, just as a test, just to get his skills and his confidence that he could then build a much bigger distillery. So that ran in earnest, very commercial volumes, literally hundreds of thousands of litres a year from 1967 right through until 1997. So that coffee and malting company had sold it to Seagram's in 1983, and then Seagram's sold it to Foster's Brewing in 1996 as part of another bigger deal with a brewery, a Canadian brewery that they sold them. And sadly, Foster's just saw all the value. They had 30,000 barrels sitting in aircraft hangars down at their old Dunedin airport. And John Elliott and his corporate asset raiders decided the real value here in this distillery we've somehow inherited is we're going to sell all the land to the university in Dunedin, which is the sort of biggest employer and a really big economic generator. And we'll sell all the whiskey in big tranches all around East Asia, so Taiwan, Singapore, South Korea, Japan. They sell thousands of barrels at a time, probably being resold as scotch, you know, it was good enough whiskey. And then they sold the last 600 or 700 barrels were bought by the Prestons, the winery family from up at Mills Reef. So, you know, it's a sad outcome because when that closed in 1997, it was the same time Bill Larkin got his distilling license in Tassie and, you know, New World Whiskey was just starting to take off. So here they are closing this huge distillery when Japanese whiskey was becoming trendy, you know. So anyway, life's easy in hindsight, isn't it?
What could have been?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So then you and Bill have had a look at all these whiskies and you're kind of thinking this stuff's not bad.
Yeah.
How did things unfold from there? You had a bit of a conflict of interest with the valuation then if you decided that you wanted to buy it.
No, well, we actually didn't. No, we did our job. We got paid a fee to give them some numbers and justify those valuations, you know, around the gross margins that could be expected at certain prices. And then we walked away and settled up. But 2 months later, the accountant came back and said, Greg, we cannot get any interest in this whiskey with anyone we've talked to in New Zealand at anywhere near that price you've talked about. Do you want to have a look at it? So I then raised the money with an American financier who's backed me into a couple of our projects as well as a Sydney-based private equity group. So we then bought the whiskey. And luckily, actually, Nick Gerber in America said, Greg, just at settlement time, James, he said, you know, Greg, my bandwidth's pretty full at the moment, but I've committed to this deal. So how about this? I'll just lend you the money. I'll put it all in. I'll lend you the money. And then after 6 years, you can pay it back to me with X amount return. So suddenly I've gone from owning zero, but managing the whole deal, to suddenly owning 50% with a bit of a debt. And then sadly for my partners, the private equity group, who were actually a big farming group who were investing in non-farm, as in non-commodity and non-climate risk businesses. They bought into us, they bought into post offices, they bought into a Sony centre, they just bought into a mix of non-agricultural investments. And my understanding is none of those other investments went particularly well for them. And we were their only remaining asset. So they actually also gave me an opportunity to buy them out. So I was able to do that too. So I ended up owning 100% of it. And then we did a crowdfund in New Zealand, gave quite a bit of equity to some of our longer serving staff. And we went out and we've now got about 360 shareholders, most of whom just put in $500 or $1,000 and some who put in, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars. But, and that's how we've now built our own new big distillery down in Dunedin.
Anyone who doesn't know this backstory that you've just told us, New Zealand has no heritage in whiskey that's sort of known outside of probably a fairly small sector of the market. What was the opportunity that you saw to create a New Zealand whiskey and take it to the world?
Well, a couple of things. So I've actually got a lot of New Zealand heritage through both sides of my family. So we've got many cousins over there, and my father's mother was a very proud, you know, Wellington girl. And I've always had a really strong affection for New Zealand, and it, almost being for, always from Tasmania and having lived in Scotland, but I've never lived on mainland Australia. So I almost had as much affection and connection with New Zealand as I do to any part of the mainland. So to me, it was no big deal looking at that. And I knew that New Zealand is a absolutely powerful export brand. Whereas Tasmania, first of all, I'd already built a distillery there. I'd worked for Bill Lark. I love all those guys very, very dearly. And I didn't feel the need to build a distillery of my own in Tasmania because, and I didn't want to go into competition with a whole heap of people I'd sort of been consulting to or helping. So I also knew that New Zealand, you go into New York or Amsterdam or Tokyo, everyone knows what it stands for. But Tasmania is a harder export sell because even though you know how buzzy Tasmanian whiskey is domestically here, and certainly globally among really discerning whiskey geeks, there is an awareness of Tasmanian whiskey with Sullivan's Cove and the Bill Lark story. But generally the market still doesn't know much about Tasmanian whiskey. Whereas I can go anywhere in the world and say, I've got a New Zealand single malt whiskey, and they immediately know what New Zealand stands for. They know that it's most likely going to be not cheap. They know that it's going to be quality, high quality. And they know it's going to be from a pristine, pure, fresh kind of, you know, country and beautiful, you know, beautiful
cold
scenery. Yeah, that's right. So it's sort of, you know, that's what really appealed to me, that we could build a real export brand. And you can see that, James, in all of our packaging, that it's got a lot of Kiwiana in it, as some people say. It's got a lot of sort of New Zealandness, you know, a real sense of place. And that's what we've always wanted to do, is give that whiskey a sense of place so that someone in China or someone in South Africa knows what that they're getting, a proud New Zealand product.
And you had enough whiskey in those barrels just to kind of have a baseline of revenue for the next few years while you set up that distillery. And yeah, just kind of tell us through the next steps, basically, because you obviously managed to agree with Spates to help you with creating the new make.
Yes, yeah, that's been a fantastic partnership with Spates. So the very first challenge was to say, okay, the whiskey was called Milford for the single malts and it was called Preston's for the blends.
And what were the blends comprised of? What were the other? So there was the single malt whiskey, but what else was in there?
So the single malt from 1987 to 1993 were all, you know, vintages and barrel by barrel, whereas the blends were in two different styles. So they were either the red wine casks, which had started their life, their first 6 years had been in bourbon, but then decanted across into red wine barrels. Or the other was the pure Wilsons. They'd never taken any of the Wilsons out that was in good sound barrels with no leaking. So we did have a small amount of that as well, maybe about 15,000 litres out of the 80,000 litres. So what I knew I had to do was rebrand, because Milford was just this big red M. I'm not sure if you've ever seen any old bottles, but it was literally just like a stencil of the letter M. And Preston's, again, was a bit underwhelming visually. And because I wanted to create, go export, I had to, you know, really glam it up with a lot of, you know, a lot of New Zealand bling. So that's, you know, that's what we've done, and it's always been very well received, thankfully. And so we went with the South Island Single Malt, was the name of all of the single malt range, and we did cask strengths by vintage, in single cask releases. And then we did the actual South Island Single Malt, which I've actually got one of the 18-year-olds here, which Dan Murphy's picked up fabulously, and also our French distributors have been brilliant in the EU, and Gordon and McPhail were our distributors in Scotland. So, across the UK. So they all ran with the South Island Single Malt, and the blended whiskey, which we've got in our glass now, that's was the Dunedin Doublewood. So that was all that blend that had gone into the red wine barrels. And again, that Dunedin Doublewood, we put a big map of New Zealand on the bottle from a really old colonial map. And that just immediately, on any shelf and any back bar, wherever you were, you could see that's a New Zealand whiskey. Oh, I've never heard of that. I've never tried that. Let me, you know, pour me one of those. Or, you know, they were very reasonably priced, $89.99 a bottle across Australia for 700 mil. So they immediately started selling really well, thankfully.
But the Dunedin Doublewood, though, so was that from one distillery or from?
Yeah.
Right. But so what made it a blend? Just that it had had the different cask?
No, what it was. So the distillery there, Wilson's, was a blend. It was 30% straight grain, but not through a column still, but not malted barley.
Oh, but not through a pot still.
That's right. So
it was unmalted barley. So it was like
Irish style.
Single pot still Irish style whiskey.
That's right.
Okay.
Like our UK distributors call it single blended whiskey. The French call it single grain whiskey. You know, they're all different because it sort of is this strange mix where you've got 70% of it was single malt, but 30% of it was crushed barley grain, you know, with enzymes added and, you know, run through a big column still, which was actually their gin still. They made all the Boodles gin there for Australasia. They made a lot of different spirits out of there, not just whiskies. They did a lot of rum, and they did Scotch blending as well. They brought in, because Seagram's at the time owned 80% of the world's distilleries.
Right.
So they were this huge conglomerate, and Dunedin just happened to be their southernmost distillery in this little outpost at the bottom of the southern hemisphere.
So when you decided that you were going to start distilling again and you organised this agreement with Spates, what was the foundational recipe? Like, did you have something to work off from the previous iteration, or was it pretty much like, we're starting from scratch here, we've got a great backstory to tell, but we're going in a new direction?
So there's a couple of levels to that. We've been incredibly fortunate that right from when we bought the company, a distiller who worked there started at the age of 16 in 1974, Cyril Yates approached us and said, gents, if you ever need any help, I'd love to get back involved with distilling. So Cyril has just been this incredible font of knowledge and information. Plus the original founder of that distillery, Dick Borroman, was in his 70s when we bought it, and I've had many meetups with Dick. We even had some reunions of all the staff that used to work at Wilson's Distillery at the Willowbank area of Dunedin. And to be honest, after Cadbury's, that was the second most visited attraction in Dunedin through much of the 1980s and early 90s. It was a busy visitor centre, which it was almost part of their sort of Scottish heritage was this distillery. So there was a lot of sort of corporate knowledge, but also technical, you know, knowledge of how that distillery had run. We've got videos and walking throughs of it all. Ironically, Foster's sent those two big stills on a massive boat. I've got photos of this. All the distillery, all the vats, everything stainless steel and copper, they chartered a huge boat and they took it all to Fiji. So Ratu Fijian rum, which is now becoming quite visible and common around Australia, that is all made out of the Wilson stills from Dunedin, which have been repurposed in Fiji to make rum.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Yes. But the recipe, so it sort of has influences from what had been done before.
Yes.
But with a kind of a new accent on it as well, or?
Yeah, so the things that we know is they were always put into wet casks, as in fresh wet casks, straight from Four Roses Distillery in Kentucky. So Seagram's, one of the reasons they bought it was for them to break the Australian trade barriers, was if you did a level of manufacturing in New Zealand, it was a free trade agreement. So they could send all their bourbon to Dunedin in barrels, get it bottled there, and then sell it into Australia without the big import tariffs if they'd come straight from America. So we know that basically as they decanted bourbon barrels, the Kiwis were distilling the whiskey to put straight in there at 60%. So things like that, we don't char and shave our barrels. Another thing, I didn't want to make another really sort of oak influence heavy whiskey like port or sherry. I wanted it to be a very spirit forward whiskey. And that's something that, again, Wilson's distillery, there was a very, that grain whiskey was a very cereal, you know, you could really taste the biscuits in it. The family that had done it were malting, you know, they had Maltexo. So we really wanted to honour that style of it being very much a spirit forward whiskey out of American oak ex-bourbon barrels. And I don't mind using quite tired old barrels two or three times. If your new make is good enough, then the barrel doesn't have to drench it with flavours. If it's great new make with the freshness of the ferment coming through and those lovely cereal biscuity notes all in that new make with a bit of oils for the texture and the structure across the palate, then the barrel really can just be a maturation vessel, you know, to burn off those aldehydes and the esters and the high sort of proof volatiles you want to, you know, get rid of through that transpiration through the wood. And I love those spirit forward whiskies, like Wolfburn, the new Scottish one. It's like as pale as water because they're using third and fourth really old barrels. So third and fourth fill, I should say. So that's something we're having a lot of fun with. And thankfully, Michael, our head distiller, I mean, he's a great story in himself. You know, he was a farm boy, became a winemaker, fell in love with a Finnish girl, got a job in Germany to make vintages there as a winemaker, but he ended up falling in love and starting a family in Finland with Laura. They moved to Finland, so he can't make wine in Finland, so he starts distilling. So during COVID, sadly, his father fell ill, and they were back in New Zealand and sort of trapped there during COVID. So he visited our distillery, and we got in touch and said, Michael, if you ever wanted to come back to New Zealand, we'd love to have you on board, you know, with our new distillery. So we're just thrilled that his new make spirit is so fruity and sweet, and that goes into a barrel, that it just needs to lose its vapors and lose the heat out of it and mature, and a little bit of influence from the wood is all it needs, and we're really happy with that whiskey. So we'll have that today as well, our 2.5-year-old whiskey.
And so what makes it now? You were saying that some of the previous stuff, it couldn't claim to be uniquely New Zealand. What is it that you think gives it that New Zealand, that Kiwi, what did you say, Kiwiana?
Yeah, so I think that when you're working with Gladfield's Malt, who are a fabulous malting company up at Dunsandel near Christchurch, so they're a big craft malt provider to the craft brewing industry, and they're really having a good throw at getting into the whiskey scene as well. So you see a lot of Tassie and Australian craft breweries using their malt from New Zealand, but now they're supplying us exclusively down at the Spates Brewery. That gives it that New Zealand provenance. Also, our double cask is still using New Zealand red wine barrels. So that, I think the added layer that French oak gives it with that little bit, it's such a spot, you know, it's a more nutty, spicy, peppery influence you get from European oak as opposed to American oak, where you get the very classic, you know, vanillins and the caramel and the honey notes. So that French red wine influence, I think, adds that. And we've also got some really exciting peating, some smoky influences from not just New Zealand peat, but a couple of other sources, which we're not sort of publicly sharing at the moment, but two other really exciting things that really haven't been done anywhere else that we know of. And other than that, I think it all comes down to the skills of Michael and Cyril. Cyril, next year it's his 50th anniversary of the day he walked into Wilson's and started distilling. So he's 64, he's back distilling, and they both, I just think they're masters of their crafts. So in some ways, sure, is it any different to a lot of the best Scotch whiskies or the best American single malts? And I say, well, it's every bit as good, but, you know, with this New Zealand authenticity running all the way through it.
And so where are you at now with the launch? You know, when can people expect to find these whiskies?
So our first batch, which will be going out to shareholders and out to all of our sort of key stakeholders, that'll be going out before September. But then our first releases out publicly will be coming out in September in Australia. So, yeah, we've been talking with our major distribution partner here, Dan Murphy's, who have been brilliant for us over the last 10 years. So they'll be rolling it out nationally here. And then in the EU, we've got a great distributor, La Maison de Whisky, and in Japan and Taiwan and so on. So they'll all be getting it after September, right around the world.
And we'll see a continuation of the double cask.
That's right.
But is there more than one product in the range?
So it's South Island single malt with no age statement.
Right.
And done in double cask with no age statement. That is already in at Dan Murphy's, but that is actually whiskey that we did through a contract distillering where we built a distillery with our bottling company. So that's not from our new distillery down at Spates Brewery.
Okay.
Yeah, so we had to fill the gap. Our bottling company, brilliant guys, Anthony and Doug Laurie, they said, guys, we're bottling so much whiskey and we know how much you got. You're going to run out. Why don't we build you a distillery and we'll distill for you? So we said, okay, and we threw in a bunch of money, and they built this beautiful little distillery out of some dairy vats, and they learned how to weld copper. It's a real Peter Bignell-like story. And they built this great distillery, and we ran that with them for 4 years, and then we swapped out our equity in that for liquid stock. And then actually, ironically, Scapegrace, the big gin company, has it now bought the Laurie's distillery and the Laurie's whiskey stocks, and that's the Scapegrace whiskey that you can now get at Dan Murphy's as well. So thankfully that's all out of virgin oak, so it's quite different in style to ours. So we stay away from virgin oak. It's just not something Michael or I particularly are fascinated with. We might do a few releases here and there, but it won't ever be our main lines.
I always hear about Dramfest and, you know, the New Zealand distilling community and how there's some other exciting whiskey distilleries. So give us an idea of, like, what's actually happening down there at the moment.
There is. It's really exciting, and it's quite different to the genesis and the evolution of Tasmania's industry, because I would say that Tasmania, a lot of real artisans and sort of mum and dad and backyard distillers, you know, have dabbled and experimented and come up with some really, you know, weird and wildly wonderful whiskies. New Zealand, it's a lot more sort of corporate investment. So Scapegrace, which started with gin, I mean, they've got an enormous amount of capital. They've just built a huge distillery on Lake Dunstan outside Cromwell near Queenstown. You know, but tens of millions of dollars invested in that. Pocono, which is Matt Johns, a fabulous guy, and his French wife, they are actually a big French cognac house. So they, and they also own Tullibardine Distillery in Scotland. So that's a long established, very strong brand, beautiful whiskies. So they've built a gorgeous distillery south of Auckland in the Pocono Hills, P-O-K-E-N-O. And that was a release that the Whiskey Club, Bertie Kaysen and Emily picked up and did a Pocono release just 4 months ago, I think it was. So that's a delicious bourbon style whiskey, bourbon cask whiskey, I should say, that's going to really go places internationally because they've got a great distribution channel already through their cognac and through their Tullibardine. And then Cadrona, Desiree and her family, a big dairy farming family, wanted to diversify, and they've built a beautiful distillery on the busy tourist road from Queenstown back towards the East Coast. And right from the day one, you know, no expense was spared in building a beautiful distillery there. And I suppose the one that's a bit closer to more of the Tassie style ones are the Auld family farmers down in Southland near Invercargill. They've built a gorgeous distillery making lovely spirits. And the other main one is Waiheke on Waiheke Island, just outside Auckland, little commute, maybe half an hour on a ferry to this very touristy vineyards and foodie haven. And the family have just made the most gorgeous distillery out there, making beautiful whiskey in it, and quite an interesting different style of distillery where they didn't do a big round copper. They actually made it's called a trapezoid. So it's all flat facing surfaces like a diamond. Mm. So just, yeah, lots of experimenting and those two are the ones a bit more like the Tassie scene, whereas all the others are sort of big corporate.
But all in all, it's like six or eight. You probably know the number, how many distilleries there are.
There's a bit more than that. There's some that I'm not particularly familiar with. There's 1919 Distilling, which is also doing some gorgeous whiskey and gin and so on. And there's another one north of Christchurch in Kaiapoi. And yeah, so there are a few others as well, but there certainly wouldn't be more than a dozen. There's certainly not more than 20 actually making whiskey. Yeah. And out in the market at the moment, I think there's about six New Zealand whiskies available, but there'll be more. There'll be 12 or 20 or 30, you know, I'm sure, within a few years.
Awesome. Well, Greg, really exciting to see these products come to market. So thanks for joining us for a chat.
Thank you very much for having me, James.